I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Perhaps the most remarkable feature of the current Middle East roadmap is that it's still on the table. It's been criticized and reviled by Israelis on the left and right, as well as by Palestinian militants and politicians. But they're still talking about it. The Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers are to meet later this week to talk more about it. U.S. President George Bush may join them for a session in a week or so. But set aside the best intentions of the leaders, and the prospects for peace look gloomy. That's because there are still so many people, Israelis and Palestinians, who are determined to tear up the map. We're going to look at the critics and what it is they hope to gain from their opposition. Next week, we'll look at the right-wing Israelis and settlers who are determined to thwart these talks. But today, we're talking about the Palestinian militant organization, Hamas. Hamas is the most powerful militant group and the one that has the most supporters. Now, it has rejected the current plan for peace. So, Connection listeners, who is capable of restraining the militants? Is there any way to persuade the critics to support peace? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like you to join us. We'll be speaking in a moment with people who study and write and report about Hamas. First, though, to a spokesman for the organization, Ismail Abu Shamab, joins us now on the phone from Gaza City. Welcome to The Connection.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr.
Ismail, tell me, is Hamas willing to support the roadmap?
I'm sorry to say no for the roadmap, but we want to give Abu Mazen a chance. So the issue is that this roadmap, according to our analysis, is surrounded by many explosions. And once you stuck into the road and you start putting your leg on the road, it will explode. So these explosions are the Israeli security demands, which are unlimited in our analysis and in our understanding of the Israeli character and Israeli behavior the last 10 years of negotiation according to Oslo Agreement.
Let me go back to what you said about Abu Mazen, the new Palestinian prime minister, who also goes by the name of Mahmoud Abbas. He's been in that job for 3 weeks. You say you want to give him a chance. Wouldn't the very best chance be to say, okay, go ahead and talk about peace, and then we'll see?
No, not like this. We want him to convince Sharon to withdraw, and the Palestinians are suffering from Israeli tanks, Israeli troops, military forces, and occupation. So when the Palestinians see occupation withdrawing, so that's the Palestinian demand. And in this sense, this will be a good starting point for all parties to live in peace.
You say you want the Israeli army to withdraw. Withdraw from where? To where?
Israeli troops now in Gaza, in Bethlehem, in Jenin, in Nablus, in Ramallah. So all over the Gaza and West Bank, there are Israeli military forces. All those military forces are on Palestinian ground, and we ask them to withdraw at least according to 1967 border.
Mr. Ismail, let me ask you, though, if the Israeli army did withdraw from the West Bank and from Gaza, would Hamas then agree to a ceasefire?
Yes, exactly.
No questions?
No.
And a ceasefire for you means no more suicide bombings, or just no more suicide bombings in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and in Israel proper?
No, it will be a good chance for peace for all nations if you find an Israeli prime minister like Sharon withdraw from 1967 border. That's the need for the Palestinian to build their own state and to live in peace side by side by Israel.
Now, I understand that part of the pressure that is on your group right now is coming from outside countries, Iran, Syria, Saudi Arabia. These are countries which have recently been offering a lot of support to Hamas, and these days they're not giving that same amount of support. Is that pressure that Hamas is feeling?
No, totally. This is wrong and misleading information. Believe me, those countries you mentioned have no influence in Hamas on the past and have no influence now. And this is the Israeli propaganda all the time just to hide their crimes against Palestinians. We in Hamas are self-supported. We are Palestinians. We want to see our people free. We want to build a good life for our people, a free life for our people, as part of the Palestinian people, as part of this region.
Mr. Ismail, I want to try and be clear so I understand this correctly. In the last few days, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has said that he supports two sovereign states. The Palestinian Authority has said that they support both the roadmap and two sovereign states. Does Hamas, as a matter of policy, agree that Israel has a right to exist?
This question needs to be discussed in two levels. One level, through the political arrangements now. And yes, Hamas will accept the proposal for Palestinian state side by side with Israeli state. Second issue, we have the Palestinian refugees who have the right to return to their homes. If those Palestinians return to their homes where they were expelled and deported, it means the whole components of the Palestinian issue solved. So, yes, we can live together.
Are you talking about a shift?
Yes.
I'm wondering if you're talking about a shift here, because there was a time when the word from Hamas was that Israel must cease to exist. But now you're not saying that.
I want to say it clear. Those are Israeli propaganda who wants to exaggerate the security of Israel and the need for security for Israel, and this is not the reality.
Okay, but let's be fair about this. There are Hamas spokesmen on the record saying that Israel shouldn't exist. Now, that's not Israeli...
When Israel denies Palestinian right for return, when Israel denies Palestinian right for a Palestinian sovereign state, it means that we never give this answer until the Palestinians get their rights. That's the issue.
Let me ask you, though, if you don't support the roadmap, if you don't support at least what's being discussed now, does that mean that you favor a continuation of life as it exists now with Israeli incursions into the Palestinian territories and more suicide bombings? Is that better than the roadmap?
No, our rejection of the roadmap is based on the issue of Israeli security demands. Second, is based on not giving the Palestinian state a border. So they spoke about temporary border. And later on, they didn't mention the right of return for refugees. Those are critics of Hamas on the roadmap. So when we reject it, it doesn't mean that we want to live like it is going now. We Palestinians suffer a lot because of the Israeli occupation. So we want to live in peace. We want to see our generation and our children live in peace. That's our goal, and we want to see it. This is the aim and the target of our struggle.
Mr. Ismail, Hamas runs hospitals and orphanages and clinics and libraries. That's part of what it does. But what it's known for around the world is its militancy, its suicide bombers. Can you imagine a time when Hamas transforms itself into a political party, when Hamas challenges the Palestinian Authority and says, we want to be the political representatives of the Palestinian people? Is that a long-term goal of Hamas?
Hamas is started as a social organization, and it insisted on social activities. But because of the Israeli occupation, Hamas turned to military activities and political activities. If the occupation withdraws, then Hamas will go back to its origin and start as a political and social movement which cares about the people's need, the prosperity of the Palestinians, and developing a better society and better living for our people.
So you would sooner be in politics than in suicide bombing?
Believe me, the suicide bombing are a reaction of Israeli suicide and savage and brutality against the Palestinians. So those will not be there if the Israelis save all of us this trouble and withdraw and leave Palestinians live alone.
Mr. Ismail, it just seems like an endless sort of circle, though. You say that you would offer a ceasefire, you might support the roadmap, but only if Israel moves first, only if the Palestinian prime minister is able to get that sort of agreement from Ariel Sharon. Isn't it also up to the Palestinian militants to demonstrate a certain amount of willingness to also offer a route to peace? You're just saying it's up to Israel and we'll wait for them.
Your logic is acceptable if we do not suffer under the Israeli occupation. But because of the Israeli occupation causes all of this pain for our people, you cannot ask the victim to not to be victim.
But
we are victims, so our resistance comes from our situation.
You know, when I ask the hand
to withdraw, that's what the logical demand should be.
But you know, when I ask that same question, Israelis can make exactly the same claim that their people are victims of the suicide bombs. Hamas, 5 bombs in 48 hours in the past week. It's difficult for you to claim under those circumstances that you're the only ones who are allowed to call yourselves victims.
Okay, we initiated an initiative. We asked the Israelis to stop killing Palestinian citizens and incursions and arresting Palestinians and demolishing their houses. And we will stop all those activities, such as martyrdom operations or any activities inside Israel. But Israelis at that time did not respect it, and they continued their attack. So this initiative also, it is given now by Hamas to Mahmoud Abbas, and we will be abide with it. If Israelis are avoiding Palestinian citizens, we will avoid Israeli citizens.
Mr. Ismail, will it be you or your children or your grandchildren who see peace in that land?
I hope that we and our children see peace, both of us, because we want for our generation and for the next generation.
Thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Ismail Abu Shamab is a spokesperson for the Palestinian militant organization, Hamas. Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, we'll talk with a reporter and a scholar who have been studying and writing about Hamas and putting it in a larger context about what the stand that you've just heard explained means for the prospects of peace. I mean, who's supposed to restrain Palestinian militant groups? Is there any way to persuade Hamas to support peace? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Investigators have found 2 black box recorders in the wreckage of a Ukrainian plane.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. In this hour, a conversation about the Palestinian militant organization Hamas, whether or not that organization should be given a seat at the table when peace is discussed. Joining us on the program now, Jonathan Schanzer. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and his research focuses specifically on radical Islamic movements. He's at the NPR studio in Washington. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us also from Israel, Ben Linfield. He's a journalist who writes on Israeli and Palestinian affairs for the Christian Science Monitor and the Scotsman, and he's at the Jerusalem Post studio in Jerusalem. Ben, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Jonathan, let me start with you, if I can, because we hear, you know, it was big news in America that Ariel Sharon said after a meeting of his party and his cabinet on the weekend that he would be willing to support the roadmap to peace. with a number of conditions. And we just heard a Hamas spokesman say, no, they're not really willing to support the roadmap to peace, but they'd consider a ceasefire with conditions. Is it more of the same, or is there any kind of shifting happening here?
Well, there's a little bit of a shift. I think, first of all, it's very significant that Ariel Sharon has accepted this. Yesterday, he convinced his cabinet to accept this roadmap and actually made a statement saying that he wanted to put an end to the occupation. He knew that this could not last forever, and I think that was a very significant step for him, given the fact that he's traditionally been seen as a very right-wing leader in Israel. But in terms of this ceasefire initiative on the part of Hamas, this is a lot more of the same. What they're talking about is a hudna, not an end to the conflict.
Explain that for me. What do you mean?
A hudna is essentially, it's the Arabic word for ceasefire. What it means is it's very temporary. Hamas's end goal is to destroy the state of Israel, and not just to oust Israel from the West Bank and Gaza, but to actually conquer all of what they see as traditional Palestine.
That's not what Ismail was saying.
What he said was that he would want Israel to withdraw at least until the 1967 borders, and talked about a ceasefire.
Allow a right of return for all Palestinian refugees.
Yes, and when you talk about that right of return, essentially what he's talking about is 3.5 million people right now who claim that they are refugees from the 48 and 67 wars, which would essentially, if all of those people came back to live in what the Palestinians see as their original homes, that would essentially mean an even number of Palestinians and Israelis, which would de facto just destroy the Jewish majority inside Israel. So what, in effect, he's calling for is a dissolution of the Jewish state by other means. So we're really not seeing much of a different tack coming from Hamas right now.
All right, Ben Linfield, you cover Hamas, the other militant organizations. You spend a lot of time on the ground in Gaza and in the West Bank. When you listen to what Hamas is saying now about prospects for peace, do you hear just more of the same?
I think we have to define what we mean by prospects for peace. If we're talking about a comprehensive peace settlement, I definitely, you know, what we've heard from Ismail Abu Shanab is not talking about that at all. I think, however, that both Hamas and Abu Mazen and the Palestinian Authority and Yasser Arafat, who I see as pulling the strings behind Abu Mazen, at this point, all may have an interest in the Hudna, which was just mentioned, a temporary ceasefire. For the Palestinian Authority, a Hudna would have the advantage, if it worked, of getting Hamas and other Islamic groups, and they would actually also have to get Fatah's militia, the Al-Aqsa Brigades, all to go along with a ceasefire. The advantage for them would be that they don't have to follow through with a crackdown, which they say they fear would result in a civil war among Palestinians. And actually, Hamas is very popular now, and it seems that it would be very hard for the Palestinian Authority to wage an all-out crackdown. And that's why both sides are talking now about the Hudna. Let me say why it may be of interest to Hamas and why Ismail Abu Shanab might be interested in it. One is Hamas does not want a civil war. Another is that they don't want to be seen as the spoilers. The Palestinian population, grassroots, West Bank and Gaza, is quite fatigued right now. They also have a mixture of anger at some of the Israeli army practices, but there's a lot of fatigue. I think there would be a good deal of support for peace moves. And Hamas has always been very sensitive and pragmatic about public opinion. They don't want to be seen as spoilers.
Ben, let me just interrupt you for a minute, because I want to make sure that I understand what you're talking about when you refer to a civil war. Right now, all Palestinian militants have one thing in common, and that is their opposition to and fight against the Israeli Defense Forces. Are you saying that a civil war could be the result of a ceasefire when these organizations aren't aiming their suicide bombers and their rockets at Israel, that they'll turn on each other?
In a sense, yes, there would be a question of them turning on each other, because a demand of the roadmap And a demand stated even more explicitly in the Israeli observations about the roadmap is a crackdown by the Palestinian Authority on Hamas and other groups in some shape or form. That would entail disarmament, and that would raise the prospect of civil fighting, because Hamas would argue that the real enemy is Israel, and how can you disarm the resistance, and that this is some form of treason.
Now, Jonathan, the idea that any one of the militant organizations would be disarmed, to me, seems far-fetched, because you'd have to have the new Palestinian prime minister, who's a member of the Fatah party, asking his own party militant organization, Al-Aqsa, to put down their weapons. I doubt that they'd do that. So if he couldn't get his own people to put their guns down, then why would he even, you know, bother asking Hamas? Because they'd laugh at him.
Well, I think that with the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, I think you have a point. It'll be very, very difficult, I think, particularly because I think Yasser Arafat probably has an interest in keeping that organization afloat, and Mahmoud Abbas will have a very hard time trying to disarm that group if Yasser Arafat is, in fact, pulling the strings there. But as far as Hamas is concerned, it's actually a very long history of conflict between the PA, or Fatah before that, and Hamas. In fact, we've actually seen over the years sort of peaks and valleys. Times when the PA has been able to rein in Hamas, has been able to arrest a number of their militants, and it's actually been quite a long battle between them, dating back to 1988 when Hamas was formed. It became the number one challenger to Fatah, which was eventually became the Palestinian Authority.
Right.
And what happened was, is during that time, both groups sought to claim control or claim credit for the uprising that was taking place at that time. After the 1993 Oslo Accords were signed and the peace process began to move forward, the PA actually reined in Hamas on several occasions, tried to bring it in under its political control, asked them to join in under a coalition. When that didn't work, arrested hundreds of militants. In 1996, actually, we saw the most amount of activity in that way, actually with the help of the United States and Israel. So what we've seen actually is over recent years, sort of a reviving of that kind of a conflict. Hamas was largely put at bay, I think, through the late 1990s. And what we saw was after this latest intifada broke out in September of 2000, Hamas became more active again, and the PA began to try to rein it in. When that didn't work, we actually saw firefights in the streets dating back in October, November, and December of 2002. You saw Hamas and the Palestinian Authority actually exchanging fire, exchanging barbs publicly, releasing communiques about each other.
I wonder if I can just go to the very latest in what's happening with the battle for public relations in the Palestinian territories. And Ben, there was a story not long ago about the IDF, the Israeli army, going into the citrus groves and the orchards of the northern Gaza, Beit Hanun, and people there saying, you know, enough with the militants. You guys fire a few rockets from here, and the Israeli army comes in and destroys our livelihood. And I read about a demonstration of Palestinians demonstrating against Hamas. You went there. What did you hear? What did you see?
Well, yeah, I'm familiar with that report, and I was in the same place that the report was filed, and I guess it's a tribute to the diversity of journalistic coverage that I had a very different impression. My impression was, upon arriving in Beit Hanun, which I had been to before, I saw a town with most of its citrus and olive groves having been eliminated over a four-day period by the Israeli army. And the anger was directed at Israel, as far as I could tell, not at Hamas. And I think actually that's been the pattern throughout the Intifada over the last 2.5 years. The Israeli army has defined this as a war for the consciousness of every Palestinian. And General Ya'alon, the chief of staff, has declared that Israel and the army have to singe into the consciousness of every Palestinian that violence doesn't pay. From what I can tell, this hasn't worked at all. And actually, you can see the latest string of terrorist attacks as more proof of that. I think the Palestinian society has been fragmented and decimated, but the motivation for violence and the support for violence is still very much there.
You mean the idea that the Palestinians would, as I mentioned in the story, eventually turn on their own militants, it's not working.
I don't see it happening unless there's a dramatic change on the ground and unless the Israeli army starts to make a greater effort to separate combatants from non-combatants.
Jonathan,
Excuse me, I just want to make this point.
Yeah.
To give you an indication of the kind of open fire practices and the kind of firing that's been going on in the West Bank and Gaza, in the last 2 years, you've had more than 2,000 Palestinians killed by gunfire, more than 10,000 Palestinians wounded by gunfire. I can't give you an exact breakdown, civilians and combatants, but what I can tell you is that the Israeli army recently announced that during the last 2 years, they have not convicted a single soldier for misuse of weapons. So that gives you an indication of the kind of firing that's going on. And in my mind, it shows that this war has been directed to some extent at the civilian population in order to have the civilian population put pressure on Hamas, as you referred to in Beit Hanun. I don't think it's worked at all. And if we look towards a de-escalation, there's going to have to be some change also in the Israeli army practices.
Ben, let me stop you there because I do want to hear from Jonathan on the idea that the policy has failed. The policy of punishing the families of militants, the neighborhoods of militants, is really only just making Palestinians angrier or more determined to fight against the Israelis.
I don't think it's failed actually at all, which I think is also a testament to just how different analysts interpret the situation. The way I look at it right now is that the Palestinians are utterly dejected and defeated at this point. The 2.5 years of this uprising has taken such a toll on these people that they are now divided. I think when this intifada first erupted, there was a certain amount of unanimity among the Palestinians that this was the right move, that this was the right tack to take. And at this point, there are quite a number of different voices arising. I would say the strongest of which could be Mahmoud Abbas himself, who decided that violence was the wrong way to go, and this is one of the main reasons why the United States has supported him as prime minister. So what you look at right now is a Palestinian people that are no closer to a state than they were when this violence first erupted, and I think now they're beginning to look for other answers. There are, I think, less and less people that are coming out into the streets at this point. Of course, that hasn't meant an abatement of violence. The suicide attacks are carried out largely by Hamas and Islamic Jihad, rejectionist groups that want to keep this fire burning. It is certainly in their interest to keep the misery of the Palestinians there.
Okay, Jonathan, I want to try and get some of our callers in, and I fear the three of us could go on and keep them out. Let's go to Green Bay, Wisconsin. Syed's on the line. Hi, Syed.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
My question is, I want to address something that you alluded to in the beginning.
Yeah.
And that is the source of funding for Hamas and whether Hamas is even the proper counterparty in any sort of peace discussion. Whether the proper counterparty is not the sources of funding for Hamas, particularly Iran and Syria, and particularly Iran, who exploits the Arab-Israeli conflict for its own purposes.
Are you saying putting Iranians and Syrians at the table of peace negotiations?
Not necessarily, but diplomatically or even potentially militarily, isolating them.
All right. Hang on just a sec, Syed. Let me go back to – don't go away because I want to bring Ben in on this. Ben, you heard what Ismail said about it just being propaganda that Hamas got its money from Damascus and from Saudi Arabia and from Iran. What can you tell us about that? That seems to be playing with the truth a little bit.
Well, I see. Actually, if we think back to Ismail Abu Shanab's conversation, I think he actually made a valid point in saying that Hamas is really a local organization and it has grassroots support. And what I would comment on the idea of broadening things to bring in countries like Iran, if you look at it, it's going to be so miraculous if the Israelis and Palestinians can somehow be nudged a little bit forward towards de-escalation. I think that's where the attention has to be. And I think really the efforts have to be placed in winning public opinion on both sides to go ahead with the roadmap.
If I could just jump in for a moment, you know, I think that there is a common misperception that it is a local organization. It certainly arose as one in the late 1980s. But at this point, Hamas gets a great deal of its funding from Gulf states, not from actually the governments themselves.
How do we know that, Jonathan? I mean, nobody seems to be able to put their finger on it.
Well, this has been very well documented. A lot of scholars of Hamas will talk about the internal Hamas and the external Hamas. In other words, the external Hamas will be the financiers, the people from overseas. In other words, Hamas can't get, if you look at the kind of economy that we see right now in the Palestinian Authority, it's impossible to imagine that this group is self-sustaining as it is. I mean, this is a highly operational group with a lot more sort of advanced weaponry than we would imagine. They're developing a missile right now. In other words, that money has to come from somewhere, and it's been very well documented by people who, you know, make it their business to study Hamas, that money does come from outside. And I think that Syed is probably right in saying that we need to take a look at some of the external players, maybe not Iran and Syria, although they certainly do have a great deal of influence on them, but also some of the financiers and maybe some of the other Gulf countries as well.
Ben, it's very complicated. Ben Linfield, are you there?
Yes, it is very complicated. That's true. I would just say that while they may, I don't know the finances, the situation of what kind of monies they're getting from outside, but I would say that public support in the streets in Gaza is very genuine for them and very strong. And that's why I think the Palestinian Authority is going to have its work cut out for it in moving ahead and trying to stop attacks.
All right, Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, that's specifically what we'll be talking about. What will happen when the two prime ministers, Mahmoud Abbas and Ariel Sharon, meet on Thursday of this week, as they're scheduled to do now, and then in a week or so, if plans for the U.S. president to join them go ahead, what kind of progress can be expected as they pore over the roadmap, as long as you have organizations like Hamas who are determined to make sure that it doesn't happen? This hour, on this day, we're taking a specific look at Hamas. Next week, we'll be talking about the way that right-wing Israeli political groups and settlers are also doing their best to try and scuttle the peace process. But let's focus on Hamas. Should an organization like that, for example, be given a seat at the table or be allowed at the talks in any fashion? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Boston Gamma Knife Center at Tufts New England.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Joining us on the program today, Ben Linfield, journalist who writes on Israeli and Palestinian affairs for both the Christian Science Monitor and The Scotsman. He's in the Jerusalem Post studio in Jerusalem. Jonathan Schenzer is also with us. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He specializes in radical Islamic movements. And we're talking about, specifically on this program, Hamas and the position that they're taking, making it somewhat more difficult for the new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas to claim support of Palestinian people when he goes to meet both with his counterpart from Israel and with President George Bush, which is expected sometime in the next week or so. Our telephone number again, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go straight back to the phones now. Michael's on the line in Burlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. One thing that's often occurred to me is that the region is economically depressed and that it might be a good idea to add to the roadmap some kind of principle whereby foreign corporations would create jobs both for Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank as part of that roadmap, so that there is an incentive to both sides to improve their quality of life if they stick with the map.
Ben, let's start with you on this one, because I think Michael's got a very apt point. My last look at the figures showed me that 50% of all employable Palestinians in the West Bank and the occupied territories who would like to work cannot work. And that's got to have a large factor in, you know, giving them the time to think about other activities like suicide bombing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It does give time for thinking about other activities, but even if people won't go to the conclusion of becoming a bomber, it does lead to a lot of frustration, anger, and depression.
Right.
And I think you also have to look at the Israeli side. The Israeli economy has been very hard hit, and in fact, that was one of Prime Minister Sharon's reasons in which he urged his cabinet colleagues to go ahead with the roadmap. I think what we've just heard is a very good idea.
And Jonathan, is it possible? Is it likely? Is it something that George Bush could take to the tables, a promise to use whatever influence he has or you know, the EU or Russia to work at trying to create jobs for Palestinians as part of an incentive to move towards peace?
I think it's a great idea. I think that actually it's very interesting to see that right now one of the main focuses right now that we're seeing is that the Palestinians are trying to become a little bit more transparent. What we've seen over the last eight or 10 years or so under this PA, under Arafat, has been an incredible amount of corruption. And for this reason, there are millions and millions of dollars that were sunk into the PA that were squandered. And the Palestinians are very, very frustrated about this. So right now we have a new finance minister inside the PA, Salam Fayyad, who is working very, very hard to create a certain amount of transparency with the PA. Although, you know, I do want to mention one thing, though, that, you know, the Palestinians are in the situation that they are in right now, largely because of the fact that they have chosen a sort of a low-level conflict. The fact that 50% or more are unemployed right now inside the territories is a direct result of the fact that they cannot get in to Israel. Israel has traditionally been the largest employer of Palestinians, and when this intifada erupted, the Israelis, I think, rightfully closed their borders, not wanting to allow suicide bombers or potential murderers to come into their borders, and this is one of the main reasons why we see unemployment right now at the state that it is in the PA.
And Ben, I wonder if you can look ahead a little bit, because when I first started traveling to Israel, as Jonathan just pointed out, there were thousands of Palestinians crossing those borders every day to work in Israeli markets and in, you know, largely blue-collar jobs, but also at universities. And that's all seems in many ways to be more than just temporarily disrupted, but possibly permanently broken in the 2 years or two plus years of the past intifada. Those people have been replaced by Chinese, by Thai, by other foreign workers. So the integration that used to bring Palestinians and Israelis together, is that ever going to happen again?
I think it could happen again, and I think it's too early to say that it's always going to be Romanians working at the Israeli construction sites and not Palestinians. It wasn't, you know, out of anything except for mutual interest that this economic relationship developed. The Palestinians needed the work. The Israelis needed the cheap labor. Now, I just want to tell you that I have sometimes heard from Israelis that they very much miss their Palestinian workers and that the Palestinian workers did a much better job than the foreign workers. And also there's sort of this, I've noticed there's a certain chemistry. I haven't seen it because the Palestinians haven't been coming in. But in the past, there's been a certain chemistry between the Israeli employer and the Palestinian workers that just isn't there with workers that come in from Eastern Europe or from Thailand.
All right, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Worcester, Massachusetts, and Ellie's joining us. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. You know, I think I represent a vast majority of, or not vast majority, of, but majority of Israelis that really, you know, 5 or 10 years ago were very active in regards to get to a compromise with the Palestinians and go forward with the peace. What Hamas represents, and in a way became a concern of many Israelis, that it's a kind of a conceal, hide the wish of all Palestinians is totally destruction of the state of Israel. Hamas doesn't accept the existence of Israel. And if you're now asking the question, should we sit and table with him, I must tell you that there is definitely total mistrust, or not mistrust, but total disregard to Hamas among Israelis. Mm-hmm. And more than that, one of the problems now with proceeding with the peace process and the roadmap is the fact that many Israelis are doubting the sincere wish, even in the most moderate so-called Palestinian, in really accept the existence of Israel and really sincerely go forward with peace.
So, Eli, what do you do? I mean, if Hamas has that wide measure of public support that Ben was talking about earlier in the program, if Hamas has its own political aspirations as well as their military aspirations, what's gained by just saying you're not a part of the process? By keeping them out, isn't that just an invitation to more of the same, more suicide bombing?
I think that the answer is much more, needs to be addressed in a more wide and broad measure, because if you look at the Arab world, look how they mark the Israel Independence Day, not just Hamas, but the Arab world in general. The day of independence of Israel, when Israel is celebrating, is for them a day for mourning and for grieving. And even they use the term, I don't remember now the term, but the term shows that this is a very bad day.
It's a Nakba, I think, Nakba, is the word that they use.
Right. Now, if you look at that, one needs to understand that since Israel was established in 1948, and even before that, there is total rejection.
Eli, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I do want to know whether or not you've got an idea or a notion of the way that any kind of conversation about peace could proceed, and the way that the militant groups on both sides can be either co-opted or squashed, or what do you recommend? What do you think? Yeah.
Okay, with all of what I said, I'm very supportive now of the measure being taken, and I think Israel needs to do the best it can to go forward and speak with the moderate Palestinian. Israel needs to take a very strong measure against the radical Israelis, and Israel needs to stand very strong on the fact that the Palestinian needs to take a strong measure against their radicals, because radicals from both sides will always, you know, stop us to go forward. Now, if the Palestinians don't understand the Israelis' very suspicious and distrust that developed mainly over the last 3 years, if the Palestinians don't grab it as something very important to deal with, the fact that the Israelis don't trust them anymore, if they will address that, and it's going to show in the next few months that both sides are really sincerely committed, I think both radical groups in the Israeli side and in the Palestinian side will be able to address.
All right, Eli, thanks very much for your call. Jonathan?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a point. I think that, most people forget, and we talk about that it's a militant group, that Hamas is militant. This is a terrorist organization that's been listed by the United States, one of the foreign terrorist organizations that we've banned, that we've vowed to destroy. And I think that it's really important to remember that no peace process will move forward as long as this organization we will never see this organization with a seat at the negotiating table. This is like saying that we want to negotiate with Al-Qaeda as far as Israel is concerned.
Yeah. But if we were to wind the tape back 20 years, you and I might be having this same conversation about the PLO, which at that time was considered, only a terrorist organization and never worthy of discussion. The fact of the matter is that Hamas has the support of people in the Palestinian territories. And I'm not trying to, put a value judgment on who they are or what they represent, but if they have public support, don't you have to find a way of either talking to them or removing that support?
Hamas has that kind of support because the PA has failed. If we are able to find a way of making the PA a little bit more transparent, of being able to provide crucial services to its people, this is one of the main reasons why Hamas is popular. You mentioned that they run libraries and hospitals and other critical services for people. If we are able to make sure that the PA provided that to its people, you would see a loss of support on the part of Hamas and a growth of support for the PA. And this is what I think we need to focus on, probably not so much the roadmap right now, but I think you know, one of the things that I've been advocating is just shoring up the power of Mahmoud Abbas right now, making sure that he has support on the ground. Unfortunately, right now, if you look at the Palestinians, there are people that are coming out in support of Arafat. There are people coming out in support of Hamas. You don't see people coming out in support of Mahmoud Abbas.
All right, Ben, I need to hear from you on this in terms
of... Yes, I actually want to get back to Ellie's call, and I have to say I was very touched by the sincerity of what he said, and this is clearly a man who truly desires peace, and I believe, it may sound naive, but I'll be a naive journalist for a moment, I'm convinced that most, the clear majority on both the Israeli and Palestinian side want peace. And this public opinion, deep in their gut, maybe they're not talking about it now, maybe they're afraid now, but they need to be given hope on both sides. And regarding what Ellie said, I think he made a very valid point that the Palestinians have made a major failing on the issue of assuring Israelis that they recognize Israel's right to exist and to remain a secure state in the Middle East. For their own reasons, including domestic reasons, they keep talking about the right of return, and every time they mention that, the red lights go off in the minds of Israelis such as Ellie that the Palestinians still want to destroy Israel. There's only one or two major Palestinian politicians who have made clear that at the end of the day, Israel as a Jewish state is going to be recognized. And I think they've gotten themselves in a trap right now. They feel they have to adhere to the right of the return as a negotiating tactic, and also because the refugee constituency is very powerful and very powerful in the Fatah faction. But they're going to have to do something to convince the Israelis that they accept a secure Israel and that there are no qualifications about that.
So, Jonathan, what's the way out? How does this Palestinian prime minister, 3 weeks in the job, gain the sort of profile and credibility that might allow him to persuade people that he's got a better way?
Well, first of all, he's got to undermine the power of Hamas. This is the foremost challenge that the PA has always had, and he's going to have to find ways to either incarcerate militants or to undercut the kind of support that they have on the ground, which, as I mentioned, is really, I think, would be a result of providing the key social services that the PA has failed to do until now under Yasser Arafat. Also, he needs to get Yasser Arafat off of his back, as most analysts would tell you. Arafat is still pulling the strings and can really make or break Mahmoud Abbas. There needs to be a little bit more of a consensus among the Palestinian people, and Abbas is going to have to move forward as a leader. Unfortunately, I think that meeting with Ariel Sharon won't exactly gain him clout on the ground right now, nor will meeting with Bush help him for that matter.
Thank you both for your time on this. Jonathan Schanzer, good to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Jonathan is a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And Ben Linfield, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Ben Linfield is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor and the Scotsman, based in Jerusalem. Earlier in the program, we talked with Ismail Abu Shamab, who's a spokesperson for Hamas. We had help with our program today from Kim Bachari, Darren Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Hour two of The Connection with Dick Gordon is coming up, and they'll be talking all about the culture of high-stakes poker. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the 10 o'clock news on WB56, clear and concise with the most important stories of the day, news that fits a busy life.